Sanders' political revolution from within.
The question really is for readers, you know, why should we care? Why is Bernie Sanders important? What does his candidacy mean and what's interesting and unique about it? And I think what it is that he's the first time since George McGovern that the liberals and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party have had a real candidate beyond a symbolic run. This is a real, I mean, you know, there is a scenario in which Bernie Sanders is elected president.
That's political cartoonist Ted Rall. Later in the show, we talk with him about his new book, Bernie. But first, Paul Theroux talks about his latest book, Deep South.
History has cast a long shadow over the South. It's the shadow of slavery, and it's the shadow of the civil rights movement, and it's the shadow of poverty, which is that people who really never caught a break are still not catching a break. And so there's a sort of entrenched poverty, changelessness about a lot of the rural South.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Paul Theroux is one of America's greatest travel writers. From the time he published his 1975 bestseller, The Great Railway Bazaar, he's been entertaining readers about his travels throughout the globe, the Americas, Oceania, Africa, and more. Now he's turned his sharply observant pen to his own country, but to a region that is little known by many Americans, the rural Deep South. Theroux was inspired by James Agee's 1941 classic, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. In the book that resulted, Deep South, Theroux describes a region mired in crushing poverty, virtually forgotten by America's leaders. Yet there is hope, a kind of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps hope that Theroux found as he meandered along back roads in search of subjects. Paul Theroux's previous travel writing is often marked by a heavy streak of irony, even misanthropy. But Deep South evinces a profound respect for those he found and talked with. He encountered ministers and social workers, farmers and laborers, black and white, and mostly poor, who are doing their best to make their communities places they can thrive in. But he also found that history casts a long shadow against the past, with its legacy of slavery, inequality, and marginalization. I spoke with Paul Theroux in November and started out by asking him about travel writing, which he says typically involves a mock ordeal. And I asked him how his book Deep South differs from his other travel memoirs. Before we get to the meat of the book, you write most interestingly about travel writing and how this book is different from most travel writing, even your own. You talk about something called the mock ordeal, which I instantly recognize from having read your other books. And this one was quite different, I agree. So explain the difference.
The main difference is the travel book is typically a book about a struggle. It's struggling from one place to another. You leave home, you go to a place, go to Africa, someone has a lot of trouble struggling through the jungle to find something. And the book becomes about, the subject of the book is the struggle and the person making the struggle. So, I mean, that's typically what the book is. It's a journey from one place to another, and all the obstacles. But when you're traveling in the States, there are no obstacles. You get in the car, you go to the place, there's no struggle, there's no obstacle. You get there. If there's an obstacle, it's really making friends and establishing some sort of trust so that people will talk to you. But there's no ordeal. When people write about the States, they often invent an ordeal. And I gave an example of Bill Bryson. He's a wonderful writer, but writing about the States, he decided to go up the Appalachian Trail as though he was going, you know, on a trek through the Himalayas or through Africa. Well, the Appalachian Trail is just the Appalachian Trail. It's, you know, you can do it for 3 days, you can do it for a week, you can do it for, you know, however long it takes to go from one end to the other, months. And so it becomes like an old-fashioned struggle along a trail. He meets a bear. They made a film about it recently. He thinks the bear is going to eat him. The bear doesn't eat him. And that's one kind of travel book. It's the old-fashioned kind. Or British people coming to the States and get very worried. You know, Americans have guns. The crowds are very threatening. Oh, it's so difficult. But actually, that's pure invention. So what occurred to me was the honest book about the States isn't about a struggle. It's not about danger. It's not even about a travel writer. It's about other people. It's about the people that you meet and the things that you see. And it's not about difficulty or risk or stamina. It's merely about getting in your car and going somewhere and trying to make a friend and encourage them to talk to you and hear their story. And then you write about where they live, what they do, the food in the area. And the discovery that you make if you're traveling in the South is that the people really have been overlooked. A lot of the industry has left the South. Manufacturing is gone. There's no work. I'm talking about the rural South now. And it's quite a depressed and deprived place that's still overlooked. The other thing you discover is that someone like Bill Clinton wants to save the world, goes to Africa, mm-hmm. and is trying to, or he goes to Nairobi, Kenya, for example, and is received by the applause of tens of thousands of people in a stadium. And they're all cheering for him because he's helping them. He's helping them with AIDS or malaria or roads or schools. But actually, Kenya is a notoriously corrupt government. They have gotten hundreds of millions of dollars from the American government, maybe billions, and they've wasted it. So Bill Clinton is there to save them. If you go to Arkansas, which is Bill Clinton's stomping ground, where he became a politician and he was governor for almost 12 years, you find Arkansas has many of the same problems that Kenya has. They have overworked people. They have people who are unemployed. The people who are underpaid. Infant mortality rate is pretty high in Arkansas. Schools are pretty bad. The roads are good, you know, in general. But they have many of the problems that you find in the third world. And yet, a lot of Americans see their mission as saving the world, saving a third world country. So that's one of the paradoxes that you meet if you go through the South with open eyes.
Yeah, in fact, you met people who are involved in development projects, building homes for low-income people.
Yes, I met lots of them, they're very admirable people. So yeah, it was very interesting to see that.
And yet they were doing what they were doing with maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe a million, you know, would be huge. And they were quite surprised when you told them that hundreds of millions were being spent abroad.
Yeah, very, very fascinated by it. They're doing it on a shoestring, but they're not getting any help, you know. So, because people are, they're more interested in exotic, you know, more exotic places. I understand that. I did it myself. I joined the Peace Corps, and I was a teacher in Africa for 6 years. Then I was a teacher in Southeast Asia for three more years. So, you know, for 9 years, I was teaching abroad in other countries, exotic countries. So I understand why people want to do that. But the South, for example, I mean, what I discovered is that they could use a lot of outreach and money and help.
You've said the word honest, and that's what struck me so much in this book was, you know, the honesty with which you share yourself with them, them with you, you with the reader. You know, it's just a very frank and open book. And you found great kindness and generosity and even welcome in the South. But you all, so talk about that, but also talk about the other side, which is the streak of darkness that you also speak about.
The South is very welcoming. I found people very hospitable. But this is on a superficial level. If you go, people say hello. They say, how are you? It's a very welcoming place, much more than you'd find in the North, certainly where I come from. There's no hello and how are you where I come from on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. But I have lots of friends there, but a stranger is a stranger. In the South, they like to say, there are no strangers, you know, you're welcome. And that's a nice thing. It's a great thing. When you get a little deeper, you find that history is casts a long shadow over the South. So it's the shadow of slavery, and it's the shadow of the civil rights movement, and it's the shadow of poverty, which is that people who really never caught a break are still not catching a break. And so there's a sort of ingrained, entrenched poverty, changelessness about a lot of the rural South. Mm. It's certainly not true of the whole place. I mean, I was recently in Nashville, Tennessee. Nashville is a very vibrant, prosperous place. It's a wonderful place to visit. Not only are people friendly, there's a lot to do there, and there's a lot of work. So people from the rural South go to the cities. They go to Tuscaloosa, they go to Nashville, they go to Atlanta, and look for a life. The rural South is different. The rural South is the past, and that's where the darkness is. So you find it that things haven't changed much, that attitudes are much the same. And to give you a vivid example, I mean, I did write about Selma on my trip, but subsequently I went to Selma, Alabama, which is the scene of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where there was the marches from Selma to Montgomery. And I went and I saw the bridge. The bridge is a vivid memorial of the civil rights movement. But if you look closely at Selma, you see that Selma is very poor. It's very unemployed. It's very neglected. Housing is not great in Selma. So people go to Selma. The president went with the first lady. Oprah went. Jesse Jackson went. Spike Lee went. You know, lots of people. Ed L. Sharpton went. And they got their pictures taken. Then they left. But Selma has not prospered. So even voting figures, I mean, the march on Selma was for voting rights. People, the voting statistics are very low. And unemployment is very high. So that's one of the paradoxes, is that the civil rights movement was a success politically, but the South is still economically very far behind.
And you actually put that question to Reverend Lyles, I believe it was in Greensboro. Tell us a little bit about him, but you asked him a question. You said once, you know, basically the civil rights objective was representation in government, and that's been achieved, but there's more financial hardship than ever. And so you asked him, what's next? What was his answer? And tell us who he is, and then say what his answer was.
He's a very interesting man, Reverend Lyles. He's African-American. He has a barbershop in Greensboro, Alabama, where, you know, James Aikie went. Here, next door, there's a diner. It's kind of soul food diner that he established, and you can get a good meal there. So you can get a haircut and a good meal. He's also a preacher. He has a church, small church, but it's a church. So he's got these three roles. And in the early 60s, he was in the civil rights movement, and he was an activist, and he was active, among other things, in helping Martin Luther King speak at a safe house in Greensboro. So I asked him, what's happening? And he says, he told me, we have black mayor and a black congresswoman. But then when I asked him about what else is happening, you know, how things are developing, he said, there's no money. And then he implied that there's quite a lot of racism in the town. And he said, the past is alive and well here. And in a way, that's could be the subtitle of a book, The Deep South, Where the Past is Alive and Well, you know, but that was his caption to the whole business. I found it very interesting to talk to people like him. He's a man of 83, I think, 84, and a wonderful man, but clearly he was hoping for more, and Greensboro is still nearly as poor as it was when James Aikie was there. Although, I'll say that if you go 30 miles up the road, you come to Tuscaloosa and you can get a job in the Mercedes plant there. So that's a new thing. And the University of Alabama is there. That's the kind of business in town, the university. But I found talking to older people like the Reverend Lyles much more interesting than going to Civil War battlefields or, you know, going to museums.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Paul Theroux. We're talking about his new book, Deep South. Now, as you say, the South, it's where the past is not the past. And you also connect that with defeat. Now, that's got to be a perspective more of white people than black people, I would think.
No, I would say both. The sense of defeat is strong among whites. It's the idea that this sense that they've been sort of left behind, that, where business is bad, people do feel defeated. Mm-hmm. African Americans who have the vote may still not be able to get a job, and it's hard to get a loan at the bank. And there are a lot of depressed communities. There's still a lot of entrenched racism, too. But that's not true. Only true of the South. I mean, it's true all over the, perhaps all over the world. Certainly in the North too. You don't have to go too far in the North to find bigots. So that's not just a Southern problem. But the sense of defeat is very strong among the people that I met at the gun shows. All felt that their rights had been taken away. The rights were being infringed by the federal government, and then they could recite a litany of how the Civil War was lost, and the Civil Rights Movement was kind of a defeat for a lot of whites. And then unemployment, companies moving to Mexico, companies moving to China. And now they would say, now they want to take our guns away from us. But it's like their last hope is just holding on to the gun as a symbol of what they can hold on to. Not they want to shoot people, but it's something that they want to retain. That right.
A symbol of power.
No one likes to be told what to do. What did you say?
I said a symbol of power.
Symbol of power and individuality. Certainly that power is a part of it too, yeah.
You have a very telling encounter at a pawn shop in Big Stone Gap. Now I don't remember what state that was.
Big Stone Gap is actually, it's on the border of Virginia and Tennessee, and it's the Ozark. Sorry, not the Ozark. It's the Appalachia. And it's, I went to a gun store. If you're thinking of the gun store, I went in there, and I said, can I buy a gun? The guy said, I can't sell you a handgun, but I said, I can sell you any other gun. I could sell you an AK-47 if you wanted it. And there were some people in the store. And he started to tell a story, kind of a racial story, and people kind of giggling and laughing. So there was guns, race, the whole package. But that's not typical of the South, but it was a vivid memory that I had. I have a certain amount of sympathy for people who feel that they've been left behind economically. If you don't have work, if you're kind of struggling to survive, then you feel that the world is against you, and you look for a victim. You look for an oppressor. You feel like a victim. So that was something I came across a lot, of people just feeling that they were behind the eight ball.
And I think this encounter really was emblematic because, he used the N-word, and then he kind of went off on the word hillbilly.
Yeah, so, he thought the word hillbilly was very insulting.
Right. So, and you have an really amazing digression on the N-word. I mean, amazing. Just, I don't think I've ever read such a deconstruction of this word. So, talk about that. I think we can understand why hillbilly. I mean, it really is a slur, as is the N-word. But the N-word has, is still a very complicated word, in fact, maybe become more complicated as history has progressed.
Yes, well, it's complicated because it's acceptable to use in a rap lyric or a song. And here's the thing. I mean, I have a chapter about the N-word. It's quite long, and it is a deconstruction of the word. I called it the taboo word, and I prefer to call it the taboo word rather than the N-word. The N-word sounds like baby talk to me. Don't use the N-word. But it's a taboo word. The thing about a taboo is that a taboo means that something is forbidden, but it always means that it's forbidden to a certain group of people, but it's acceptable to others. So a taboo in Africa, there was a taboo against women eating eggs, chickens' eggs. The belief was that if a woman ate chickens' eggs, she would become sterile. But it was okay for men to eat chicken's eggs. So the taboo was bad for women, good for men. Why? Well, obviously, because chicken's eggs are very tasty. So that's male domination. Man makes the rule. Very bad to eat eggs. I can eat them, you can't. That's what a taboo is. It doesn't mean all eggs are bad, that no one can eat the eggs. A taboo means some people can, some people can't. Men can, women can't. The N-word, the taboo word, is that some people can use it and some people can't. Whites cannot use the word, must not use the word. But African Americans, rappers especially, use it all the time. And Harvard awarded, in fact, just about a month ago, awarded a prize to Eric Holder, who we all know, and a rapper called Nas, N-A-S is his name. His name is Nasir Jones. Half of his songs use the word, but he just got a prize from Harvard. There's a man called Killer Mike. Killer Mike is a rapper. Killer Mike used the word all the time. He is an associate advisor, cultural advisor, at MIT. They can use it. It's very strange to live in a world where some people can use a word. Other people are forbidden to use the word. And if you're a writer, you want to know what that word is and why you can't use it. You also want to know why other people can use it. So we live in a strange world, a world of taboos, and that's a taboo. The word thug has been described as a taboo word. Thug is a synonym for the other taboo word. Now, in the South, people used it with me a lot. Whites used it as though to test me about it, to see what my reaction was. So rather than appear shocked that people would, I sometimes said, where I come from, people don't use that word. They would say, well, they certainly do here. but I, you know, I wasn't going to the South to tell people how to live or how to speak, but I was making notes about it. The other aspect of this, I'm glad you brought it up, is because my book was reviewed in a number of places. I would say it was reviewed in, I got 30 or 40 reviews of the book. No one mentioned that. No one mentioned that chapter, and no one mentioned that I wrote a whole chapter about this one word. Because it's a taboo. And in the popular papers, it can't be. I mean, maybe you read a review that mentioned it, but I was very interested to see whether anyone would bring it up, but no one did.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with the great travel writer Paul Theroux about his latest book, Deep South. Well, not only have I not read that, but as I said, I've never seen a deconstruction of the word, although you do reference deconstructions written by African Americans of the word itself.
Yeah, people have lost their jobs for saying it.
In Deep South, Paul Theroux says that the fact that blacks can use the N-word but whites cannot is the assertion of a certain privilege by people who've been subjected to the use of the word as a slur and reclaiming that word as a point of pride.
Yes, it's reclaiming it. It's also it's a source of power that if you have a taboo, if you're the owner of the taboo, you have some power. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a very big deal that I can say it, you can't, gives you power. You have power over the people who can't say it. I mean, that to me is very, it's not amazing. I mean, the world is full of people who have appropriated taboo or created taboos to hold on to power or to give themselves power. But if you have nothing except this word, then you've got something. But it's a very strange cultural factor because I'm a writer. Words are my business. Words are all I have. And I would like to think that no word is forbidden to me. And the word is not in my daily vocabulary, but if you hear it all the time from Jay-Z, from Killer Mike, from Snoop Dogg, from, you know, Nicki Minaj, name anyone on the top 40, they're using it all the time. I can't say it. I can't even repeat those lyrics without becoming an object of scorn. I mean, that's a very curious situation to be in, And yet, there it is. You know, what can I do? I can describe it, and that's why I did describe it. There have been books have been written about it, but the books are written by black writers, not by white writers. So I thought I would, as a departure, I'm writing about the South, after all. And you might say it's part of the vocabulary of the South. Mm-hmm. So I went into it in detail. And anyone who reads my book might be shocked by it, but then they would also be enlightened.
Yeah, and you also write about how people saw you in the South. You say blacks saw you as a cracker. Now, not all of them. I mean, obviously, you were very welcomed. But you say at one point that...
Every now and then, I would be seen, as a cracker.
And whites saw you as an agitator. So talk about perception
that way. If I went to a restaurant with black friends, and there were a lot of whites would look up, and they would wonder why I was there. Who was I? What was I doing? I'm probably a troublemaker. Yeah.
Yes, and also we have to let our listeners know that most people had no clue who you were. They didn't know about your fame. You only met two people who had ever read any book of yours. So how did it make you feel, I guess, to be seen the way you were without any of the usual accoutrements of your identity?
How did it make me feel is wonderful, because you don't really want to be famous. You don't want to be a recognized... I'm not famous anyway, but you don't want to be well-known. You don't want to be recognized. I would like to be treated just like everybody else. I don't want the red carpet. The best way to see a country is to go by the back door, walk across the border, and see what people, how people live in the hinterland. So I didn't mind. In fact, I welcomed the idea that I was completely anonymous. It's sort of fun to meet people. I mean, it's flattering if you meet people who read your books, then you can talk about them. But then you're talking about the books. You're not talking about what's really on your mind, which is, who are these people? What are they doing? What's their story? So I value my anonymity, and I would think that it's a really terrible thing to be to have a recognizable face. Writers never have recognizable faces, and a lot of people don't read, so, you know, that a writer's never in any danger of being swamped by well-wishers and people who love their work and so forth. That doesn't happen. Writers are nobodies in general. They're nobodies. But that's quite good. It's good to be a nobody if you're a traveler. You should be. That's how you find out. And people will tell you the truth.
Finally, before we go, is there anything else that you would like to say about this book?
Only that probably it's the most satisfying travel book that I've written for several reasons. One is I felt the greatest freedom in traveling in my own car. I also was speaking in my own language and talking to people in my own language. So the idea that I was talking to people who speak English, traveling in my own country, and I could go down any road I wanted to go, was a very, very liberating, very enlightening experience. I've never had that before. I've always felt traveling that I'm struggling to get to a place and then struggling to understand. I never felt that. I always felt that I could have a conversation with people, and that I would I could understand what they were saying. I didn't need an interpreter, and that I could go my own way. I felt so liberated that after I took my first trip, it was the fall of 2012, I thought I was determined to go back in the winter and then in the spring and in the summer, and just to keep going back, to dig deeper, to see more. I hope a reader would have a similar reaction to the book, that they feel as if, you know, that it was a liberating experience. It's also something that people can do themselves. I said about Southern writing. People talk about how rich the South is in its writing, and I think it is. But they're people's stories, and I don't think that all the stories of the South are in Southern fiction. How do you find out about the South? Get in your car and go there. And, you know, someone from the North in a couple of days will be in the bosom of the South and experiencing it. And then they can read about it later.
Well, I'm so grateful that you have written about it. Maybe I'll make that trip, but I don't really have to because I can read your book, Deep South, Paul Theroux. Thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
It's been a pleasure, Francesca.
Paul Theroux. You can read an excerpt from Deep South and see some of the amazing photos by Steve McCurry that accompany the text by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Bernie. Stay tuned after the break.
Let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag. In the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America. All come to look for America. All come to look for America.
I'm Bernie Sanders, and I approve this message.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Whether you think Bernie tied with Hillary in the Iowa caucuses or lost by a razor-thin margin determined by coin tosses, it's clear his campaign is having a seismic effect on the American political landscape. My guest Ted Rall is writing a trilogy about how political change happens. A few months ago, we spoke with him about his book Snowden, the first in the series. Now he's come out with Bernie. It examines how Bernie Sanders is trying to spark a political revolution from inside the Democratic Party as he brings his campaign for the party nomination to the 50 states. Bernie has focused less on the candidate's biography, although that's there too, and more on the Vermont senator's campaign, its place within the history of the Democratic Party, and its prospects for creating real change from the grassroots. I spoke with Ted Rall back in December, just after the third Democratic debate. Ted Rall, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me, Francesca.
We spoke to you not too long ago about your biography of Edward Snowden, and now an other biography is out. This is about Bernie Sanders. And first of all, like I asked you about Edward Snowden, why did you want to write a book about Bernie Sanders?
Well, I was interested after doing the Edward Snowden in what it takes to affect change and biographies about people who try to affect change. And I was interested in going in a different direction from someone like Snowden. Snowden was a rebel. He operated outside the system. He's literally a renegade. He's an outlaw. He's literally wanted for very serious crimes and is forced to be living in exile in Russia as a result. And then here you have Bernie Sanders, who almost single-handedly has restored hope to the progressive liberal wing of the Democratic Party for the first time in my lifetime, really. And I thought, well, here's a guy who had the makings of a rebel back in the 60s, but he's consistently worked within the system, within the electoral system, to try to affect change as mayor of Burlington and then in Congress and then, of course, in the U.S. Senate and now as Hillary Clinton's principal challenger for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016. So I just thought it would be interesting to do a trilogy, actually, of books about biographies of people who are trying to effect change in different ways, outside the system, inside the system, and then we could talk about the next one, if you want, which will probably be about Pope Francis. So Bernie is a rebel within a system. And then the Pope is not a rebel. The Pope is nevertheless effecting change from within a rigid hierarchy. So it's three different approaches to trying to effect change. I would say what's probably missing here is a revolutionary, but that's because we don't have any in the United States, unfortunately.
Well, that's so interesting. Those three different means of change. You start out the book with a walk down Democratic Party lane. You start with the electoral bid, the campaign of George McGovern, which I actually remember pretty well because it was the very first time I voted, and I voted for McGovern.
Yeah. Well, I thought when you're talking about Bernie Sanders, you know, it's a different story from Snowden. Snowden was a guy who started out as a right-wing libertarian and had a political conversion and had a political journey that he changed a lot in his 20s as a result of his experiences working at the CIA and the NSA. But Bernie Sanders has been remarkably consistent. He was born to parents who were politically very similar to the way he is now, and his politics were pretty much fully formed by the late 1950s, and he's been pretty much the same guy ever since. So the question really is for readers, you know, why should we care? Why is Bernie Sanders important? What does his candidacy mean, and what's interesting and unique about it? And I think what it is that he's the first time since George McGovern that the liberals and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party have had a real candidate beyond a symbolic run. For example, George McGovern running again in 1984, which is forgotten about now. This is a real, I mean, you know, there is a scenario in which Bernie Sanders is elected president. That was never going to be true about McGovern in 84. So I felt that what needed to be framed was the fact that the Democratic Party has been moving to the right steadily ever since 1972. And what happened was that election was disastrous even before it happened. There was so much that went wrong. There was the Watergate scandal, people forget, really did begin before the 72 election, but it didn't really catch fire until afterwards. And by then, Nixon had been reelected by a landslide. And then, you know, there was the disastrous Eagleton affair. And, you know, Nixon cheated six ways till Sunday. Thomas Eagleton was originally George McGovern's vice presidential running mate, and it was revealed during the campaign, I think during the summer of 1972, that he had received not just psychiatric treatment, which today is commonplace, but at the time was considered scandalous and possibly a sign of weakness or a personality flaw, but also possibly he had received electroshock therapy. So people were like, well, he's crazy. You have to dump him. McGovern was put in a no-win situation. If he kept Eagleton, he was going to be an albatross. So he dumped him. But then by dumping him, he was perceived as weak and disloyal. So either way, here you have this kind of bizarre scenario. I guess you could say it's kind of a prequel to the swift boating of John Kerry in 2004 of a true, genuine hero of World War II, an amazing pilot, brave guy, George McGovern was, who ended up being characterized as weak and wimpy and unable to stick to his guns. And this was during the end of the Vietnam War. And Nixon and his strategists were brilliant. And they did cheat. And they pulled all sorts of dirty tricks. They pulled out all the stops. And, you know, they wanted to be running against McGovern anyway. They killed Muskie in the primaries. Edmund Muskie was the guy that they really thought was the big threat. So they pulled out all sorts of dirty tricks to get rid of him. Anyway, the point is that Nixon trounced McGovern. And after that, there had always been a conservative wing within the Democratic Party led by the Southern Democrats, the old Dixiecrat coalition. And they were empowered by this to argue within the party that they needed to move the party to the right, that America was a conservative country inherently. The voters were far to the right of the Democratic Party, and that the only way that the Democratic Party would be able to win elections would be to go with what they call the Southern Governor strategy, which is how you get Jimmy Carter in 1976. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't organic. Jimmy Carter was an organic candidate, but nevertheless, he benefited from that idea of let's get a conservative Southern Democrat. And he did win, although not by as much as you would expect, but he did govern significantly to the right of Democratic precedents like LBJ and JFK, and certainly Truman and FDR. He was, for example, very hawkish on defense. He started what later became thought of as the great Reagan defense buildup. But he began that in 1978 with his defense budget. He was a real cold warrior. When the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in 1979, which was something that really the U.S. had a hand in provoking, Carter boycotted the Olympics in 1980 in Moscow. he handled the Iran hostage crisis in an aggressive way militarily. I mean, Carter is remembered as a peacenik, and he's very ill now, so he may die any moment. And when he dies, or I know he's getting better, but I mean, he's still old. And when he dies, he's going to be remembered as this great liberal pacifist president. But that's really not true.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Ted Rall about his newest political graphic biography, Bernie. Okay, so Carter, and then came Bill Clinton.
Well, I don't think we want to omit the fact that the Democratic Party kept running increasingly conservative candidates throughout the Reagan and Bush 41 period. So we had Jimmy Carter ran for re-election, of course, in 1980, lost to Reagan disastrously, despite being hawkish and to the right of traditional Democrats. Walter Mondale was kind of a throwback to the more liberal tradition, being from Minnesota, but he was trounced, even though Reagan was dealing with a massive recession and high unemployment in 84. But the Democratic Party just couldn't coalesce around him. Dukakis was another disastrous candidate running against George H.W. Bush. So yeah, you end up with Bill Clinton. And throughout this whole period, there are these organizations within the House of Representatives and then within the Democratic National Committee, like subgroups, like little cabals, that later end up metastasizing into something called the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, which really became the organ of Clintonism under Bill and Hillary Clinton in 1992. And they won big, and they really said that their Southern Democrat, conservative governor kind of approach was like the DLC argued, oh, this is obviously the sweet spot because this won and Clinton won big, conveniently omitting the Ross Perot factor, which was huge in 1992 and split the conservative vote far more than it split the liberal vote. I think without Ross Perot, Bush would have been reelected. But they did argue for this. Now, throughout this entire period, bear in mind, we have the media talking about how the United States is a conservative country. It's the height of the Cold War before the collapse of the Berlin Wall, and Reagan gets credit for it. And the media is becoming increasingly corporatized, and left-wing voices are vanishing from the opinion pages of newspapers and from places like national television news. So just the 50-yard line of American politics keeps getting pushed to the right. The Republicans are getting more conservative. The Democrats are chasing them. And that's mainstream electoral politics. And that keeps happening under Clinton. I mean, Bill Clinton basically has three major political achievements during his two terms in office. And those are the North American Free Trade Agreement and the World Trade Organization, GATT. So basically, massive liberalization of trade, usually at the expense of unions and workers. And then welfare reform, the end of, as he called it, the end of welfare as we know it, which put a lot of people out on the street and did end welfare as we knew it. It abolished a big part of the safety net. It caused a spike in homelessness, hidden homelessness, not the 80s style of homelessness. This is the homelessness where someone you know has like relatives crashing on their couch for years at a time. Those were his big achievements. And then there was Hillary Care, which was like the prequel to Obamacare, but that never got off the ground. And I would say that the only way you could really argue that Bill Clinton did govern as a liberal was he was relatively not as belligerent or hawkish on defense as, say, Jimmy Carter had been, relatively. But nevertheless, there was an intervention in Bosnia and constant bombing of Iraq after the Gulf War throughout the 90s, to the point where they were literally sending out jets and they were coming back with their bombs still attached because so much had been destroyed that there weren't enough targets left to continue to bomb. So that was Bill Clinton. And he was a conservative Democrat. By the standards, I mean, it's important to understand that someone like Bill Clinton or even Barack Obama would have been to the right of someone like Richard Nixon in 1972. Richard Nixon definitely was more liberal. I mean, you would never have seen wage and price controls under a President Clinton or a President Obama, which Nixon did impose and earned the enmity of the business community, and the CEOs hated him for it. But he felt still, he may be the last president who felt that the government was in charge of the economy not the corporate community. Then you have, of course, you have George W. Bush come in. He runs as kind of as a Rockefeller, sort of a neo-Rockefeller liberal Republican, but at 9/11 transforms him, and his cabinet is full of hard right neocons, as I think anyone listening to this knows about. I'm not going to go through the whole Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz thing, but you know, everybody knows what happened after 9/11. And the Democratic Party kept running centrists. John Kerry in 2004 was challenged by Howard Dean briefly, but that challenge was shot down. There had been some other challenges from the left within the Democratic Party, or you could say sort of slightly within the Democratic Party. I mean, Ralph Nader ran as an independent in 96 and 2000, but he was essentially a liberal Democrat, and he was blamed in 2000 for costing Al Gore the election against George W. Bush, in my judgment, unfairly. I think Al Gore won Florida fair and square, and it was taken away from him by the Supreme Court. And then in 2008 is kind of an interesting primary race that's now forgotten, because you kind of had the three strains of politics within the Democratic Party all running against each other in those primaries. Obama was the centrist. Hillary Clinton was the hawkish conservative DLC candidate. And John Edwards was the old-fashioned progressive liberal, ironically from a southern state, North Carolina. But the media deprived Edwards of oxygen, didn't give him any coverage, very much like Bernie Sanders is experiencing this year. And so he never stood a chance, because he just didn't have the ability to get any support from the DLC, and he couldn't get his ideas out there. And I think in a weird way, the economy had only started to melt down in the spring of 2008. If he had run 1 year later, he probably would have been elected president in the atmosphere, the anti-capitalist atmosphere of the spring of 2009, when America was losing 500,000 jobs a month. But he was a little too early. And
he had a scandal.
But the scandal happened later, right? I mean, people didn't find out about his mistress until after he was already had already lost the primaries. So, and then, you know, then you have the remarkable 2012 election, where Obama literally runs in a coronation primary unopposed. I mean, on the Democratic side, that is virtually unheard of. And people thought that was going to happen again this year with 2016. I mean, Hillary had been teed up. It's been known since at least 2008 that she was going to run in 2016 for president. And certainly the Democratic National Committee was completely behind her, in her pocket. And Democrats who would have challenged her were warned off and told, this is Hillary's year. Don't, you know, step back. So Bernie Sanders decided to get into it initially after the first liberal Democrat, Elizabeth Warren, decided that she wasn't going to do it. We don't know why she decided not to do it, but I have my own theories. I think she probably just thought she probably needs more, more experience. She needs more of a resume before she can run. But I also don't think she really wants it, to be honest. She doesn't seem like she has the ego of someone who wants to be president of the United States. So once she decided she wasn't going to articulate those traditional progressive democratic values in the primaries, then Bernie Sanders said, okay, to himself, all right, I'm going to go ahead and do it, and I'm going to get in too. And so he felt that the issues needed to be articulated, and that's why he decided to do it. And I think he's almost like a dog that caught a car, in that he couldn't believe how well he did so quickly.
Yeah, so talk about the Bernie Sanders phenomenon. You were part of it in Occupy. I just read an article in The Atlantic magazine this month, which talked about a general leftward shift in American politics, which does talk about Occupy and inequality and then, of course, Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, you know, if you've been talking about the same thing for years, especially while everybody's been denigrating you and insulting you and ignoring you, and then suddenly that issue that you've always been the only person who talked about and was always mocked, it suddenly becomes the top issue in people's minds, then you're going to be thought of as a prophet. And that's what happened to Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has been talking about income inequality really since the mid-1970s. And it was identified really at the end of the Vietnam War as a phenomenon. Depending on how you count, it starts in 1968 or 1972-ish. So he had been harping away at this as mayor of Vermont, in the House, in the 80s, in the Senate, in the 90s, and constantly just no one cared. Bernie Sanders was a lot of things, but he's not a guy who got a lot of legislation passed. He was very effective as mayor of Burlington, but he was the only socialist in all of the 535 members of Congress and the Senate. So self-identified Democratic socialist, ran as an independent from Vermont from this funny little party. And so he was an outsider. And ironically, that's what legitimized him when Occupy started in the fall of 2011. A lot of people within Occupy, there was a traditional left split between reformists and revolutionaries, people who wanted to change the system to improve it and people who wanted to start from scratch. And on the reformist wing, a lot of people were looking, trying to identify mainstream electoral politicians who had integrity and who were on the right side of this issue of the 1% versus the 99%. And there weren't very many, but one of the names that kept coming up in these discussions all over was Bernie Sanders, because here was a guy who had constantly talked about it. So I think that that's when he started becoming truly nationally prominent in a legitimate way, as opposed to as a curiosity, which he had been theretofore. So he started getting invited a lot more to the Sunday morning political talk shows. He'd be interviewed more on cable news. And his profile grew throughout 2012, 2013, 2014. He worked really the media. But I think it's more that the people came to him rather than him coming to the people. They were hungry for someone who understood this issue, which was, you know, you have a country that's spectacularly wealthy, that generates incredible amounts of wealth, but for an increasingly small number of people. And it just seems really strange when you're in a country that has such a massive, constantly increasing GDP, constant improvements in productivity. If we're working so much more efficiently than we used to be, and we're producing so much more stuff, then why is it so hard to make our ends meet? And why is it so hard to send our kids to college? And why is it so hard to pay the rent every month?
Yeah, in fact, I was reading yesterday an incredible article that showed that more than 50% of Americans are at or near the poverty line.
Yeah, at a certain point, you have to wonder, maybe you need to redefine the poverty line. The fact is, this is not really a rich country anymore. This is really, truly what John Edwards called a tale of two Americas, where you really have people living in parallel universes. Go through any major airport like LAX, O'Hare, or JFK, and you will see all these ads for, you know, massive posters for $25,000 watches. And you're like, who are, you know, Bulgari, like jewelry, like who's buying these like $100,000 necklaces? Like, I don't know anyone who has that stuff or the ability to buy that stuff. Everybody I know can barely make it month to month. And that's the reality, is that we're an increasingly, there's always been a class divide, but the bifurcation is so dramatic and so radical and has become so radical in the last 40, 50 years that we are effectively living in two different realities. And so Sanders articulates that very well, simply. He has command of the facts. He has amazing statistics that he can quote. So he's been on the right side of this issue. I mean, he has flaws as a candidate, but this is the big issue. I don't care what people say about like San Bernardino and terrorism. I think pocketbook issues always prevail. And in the end, I think pocketbook issues will prevail this fall, too.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Ted Rall about his newest graphic biography, Bernie. It's about Bernie Sanders. We spoke back in December when only one more Democratic debate was scheduled. More debates have now been scheduled. And yet the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, is doing everything it can, along with the media, to tamp down on any kind of, on the ability of Bernie Sanders to get his message out. I mean, it's phenomenal he's been able to get out as much as he can, as he has. But what do you think he really can prevail against this kind of blackout?
Yeah, I mean, there is a blackout. And there's been studies that have shown, I think Media Matters found that Donald Trump has received 24 times more coverage on the major CBS, NBC, ABC TV network news as Bernie Sanders. And I've confronted some of the gatekeepers in media about this. And what they say is, well, you know, Bernie's boring. He's not saying that, Hillary Clinton got schlonged, and he's not saying that, John McCain is a schlub and not a war hero. And he's not saying that, like Donald Trump did, that all Muslims should be banned from the United States. So that's true. I mean, Bernie Sanders, I just did a cartoon about what Bernie Sanders could do to be more like Trump, ban the billionaire class from the United States. And it is true that in that sense, Bernie is he's certainly less entertaining than Donald Trump. There's no question about that. But I think that's only a partial excuse. The fact is, ideology is behind it. He's the biggest electoral threat to the status quo and to the major corporations and the billionaires that control them. So obviously they don't want his message to get out. It's not like a grand conspiracy. It's more like everybody who works at these networks is smart enough to know which side their bread is buttered on, and they just don't book him and they just don't quote him. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, polls have shown at various times that 37-ish% of Americans favor socialism over capitalism as an economic system. Now, that's in a country that's a Cold War country with red scares, where communists get no airtime, where Marxism is never taught in schools. Nobody even knows what it is. And so if you can imagine, in a country with that many poor, unhappy people, if a message about economic equality and egalitarianism were able to get some oxygen, you can imagine that it would probably become more popular. So clearly the media is actively conspiring to keep someone like Sanders from getting his message out. But I think he also is going up against the DNC. The DNC seems to understand that to know Hillary Clinton is to not love her, and that the more she talks, the less popular she becomes. That's certainly what happened in 2008. It's why she lost against Barack Obama, despite having an early lead in the primaries, and most of the advantages of money and name recognition and so on, and being white. But nevertheless, the more she talked, the less people liked her. She kind of gets on people's nerves. She doesn't seem to care much about ordinary people. She seems to care more about herself. And her campaign seems to be about herself and not about people. They're deliberately hiding Bernie and her and O'Malley, because they know if they have high-profile debates between O'Malley, who is been pretty impressive, actually, against Hillary as well. But Sanders would get more. They don't want to risk him getting his message out to the liberal base and getting more people to get to know him. I mean, the biggest problem he faces is getting some recognition in the black community, which is an important base for the Democratic Party. You can't really win the Democratic nomination without a lot of black votes. And they don't know him. They know Bill Clinton, so therefore they know Hillary by extension, but they don't know him. And if he were able to get more exposure there, that'd be great. But the debates aren't going to give it to him.
Ted Rall, you can find an excerpt from Bernie at writersvoice.net. You can also hear Rall talk about the Iowa caucuses. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.